It's raining in England today.
It's the most excellent canopy, the air. Look you, this brave or hanging firmament, this majestical roof fretted with golden fire. Why, it appeareth nothing to me but a foul and pestilent congregation of vapours.
Richard E. Grant with a bit of Shakespeare from his first film, With Dale and I, from 1987. He's a very cool bloke. Amazing life, too. Born in Swaziland. He's my guest this week on London Calling. But first, let's stick with the theme of rain and go to Seattle, Washington. BJ Shea is the morning show host on KISW. BJ, you were listening a couple of weeks ago to the show and you heard John Mayall, and he used the word bollocks, which you don't use in America.
We don't. I don't really hear it unless it is somebody from where your neck of the woods.
Okay, so what do you understand about the word bollocks?
I feel like it has something to do in the groinal region.
Right.
I think I'm on the right track.
Yes.
But if I were to, but I would be a liar if I were to say exact, because there's a lot going on down there.
Yes.
There's a lot of territory to be discovered. It sort of looks like a Game of Thrones map.
Right.
So I'm not sure if we're in Westeros, if we're talking bollocks, if we're in Dorne. I don't know where we are. I don't know if there's a mother of dragons involved. So I'm not quite sure exactly what bollocks is. I just know maybe the general vicinity.
Okay. Well, you're on the right track because
I.
Yes. Bollocks.
Am I in the right gender? It would have been involving
The right gender? Yes. Yes, you've got that. Bollocks are testicles.
Yes.
Right.
I would have guessed that if I had to.
Right. So what John Mayall was saying was that American politics is a load of balls. Would you use balls as an expression?
No, see, that's the thing, is that we don't use balls as a way to describe something as being messed up or just a, like we would say S show. I don't know where this broadcast is going. you can tell I'm an FCC regulated American broadcaster.
I just stay within FCC just in case it goes somewhere good.
So we would say it was a crap show, but using the S word.
Yes.
That's what we would call it. We would say it's a load of crap. Anything that involving excrement is how we describe things that you, I think, would say is a load of bollocks.
Like, right.
It's horse crap. It's bull crap.
Yeah.
But we never go to the boys. The boys.
Right.
The boys never get involved in these conversations.
Well, we will use it in a descriptive form. So we might say somebody is bollock naked. Rather than just saying they're naked, we will say he was bollock naked.
So there's no confusion
Yes.
of how naked he was.
Yes, his bollocks were on display.
They were on display.
Yeah.
I like that. I bollock naked, I like.
That's, yeah.
Because normally you go, the dude was naked, you know, but I like bollock naked.
Yeah. Now,
that's a great cover band name, by the way. Somebody needs to really.
They really do. They really do. Now, also, in cold weather, we might say I was freezing my bollocks off.
Now, we will say that.
Right.
I was freezing. We will say, we don't say bollocks,
yes.
But we will go freezing my boys off, balls off, you know.
Yeah.
That kind of a thing.
Yeah. Okay. But although bollocks are balls, we won't say somebody has bollocks.
Oh.
We will say they have balls. That would be the incorrect use of the word.
Yeah, and I would like to say that we're glad to have contributed that to your lexicon. We're happy to have contributed.
Yes.
It's a great donation we've given to you. We feel like it's the least we could do. We caused a little problem over some herbal beverages. The least we could do is give you balls. You would even say we have balls, offering you balls,
yes.
Considering that we had balls in the first place, for, of course, having a party with somebody's tea. That was,
Yes.
Yeah, so boys, we agree on that.
Okay. If you get a bollocking,
ooh.
you have been disciplined. You've been told off.
Wow.
You can say, like, if I do something wrong on the radio, my boss will give me a bollocking and I will have been bollocked.
Oh.
We can flip it, though, because something that's very good is known as the dog's bollocks. If something is excellent, you can go, what was it like? Oh, it's the dog's bollocks. You might say it was a doozy. We would say it was the dog's bollocks.
Yeah, we've had the bee's knees.
Yes.
We've had that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if we have something like that to say, oh, that was, well, in poker, we say we got the nuts,
right?
You know, which is the best, you've drawn the best hand.
Yeah.
We'll use, that's when we go from ball to nuts. We now go to the cashew, we go to the walnut, we go to that family, the legumes. We go to the legume family, and then we will use it like that, yes.
Right, I see. So the mutt's nuts would be the equivalent of the dog's bollocks.
We wouldn't add the mutts, but I have to tell you, because we just go with the nuts. We don't bring the dogs into this.
I don't know why we bring the dogs into it, but we do.
I'm not sure either. I feel like we're probably a little like we love our animals, but we want to make sure people don't think we love our animals. So it could be, let's keep the mutt and the nuts in separate departments. But I will tell you,
good idea.
I like the mutt's nuts. I think,
okay. You know,
I think that there's something there.
That's the dog's bollocks. Yeah.
Next time I talk to Betty Big Balls, I'm going to tell her she's the mutt's nuts. I think that's going to put me over the top.
So to summarize, really, bollocks are balls. You freeze them off in cold weather. A bollocking is a bad thing. The dog's bollocks are good. Yeah. And if you don't like anything I do or anything I say, it means it's a load of bollocks.
I feel like I have learned so much. You know what? I've enjoyed this. I feel like we have a friendship in the business, but I feel like even beyond that, you are a jewel. And man, it's been fun hanging with you.
It's been great. It's been a pleasure. It's been an honor. Thank you for your time, BJ. How do we find out more about you and listen to your work?
Well, KISW.com. That's the station where I hang out. Or if you go on any internet thing and search for BJ Shea, and I shouldn't have to spell it because you guys know about Irish people over there.
Yeah.
You would be surprised in this country how many people don't know how to spell Shea. It is hysterical.
Really?
Yeah. Apparently Irish people aren't everywhere in America. I thought they were. Because, I mean, you know, we kind of came over here with everybody, you know, I thought. But I guess we stopped coming over here. Or maybe we only went so far. So it's BJ Shea. You should search for me and KISW.com. And we do a little morning show in Seattle, Washington. And that's where you can find me.
Please take care. We'll have to do this again.
I have no problem with that if because I love working with you. So if you can tolerate me and my crazy theories about how humanity could be better, sure thing.
Maybe we'll talk after the election.
That's a great idea, because that's going to be a spectacle.
BJ Shea in Seattle, Washington. Well, let's now head over to the other side of the country, to Philadelphia. Jim McCabe is on Skype. Jim, your question is, do we have the scary clowns craze in Britain? Yes, we do. There's a name for a phobia of clowns, isn't there?
Fear of clowns is called coulrophobia.
Well, it might not be classified as a phobia for much longer, because a phobia is an irrational fear. And it turns out that these clowns are, well, there's reports that they're attacking people with, like, knives and that.
My all.
And because of that, when people see clowns now, they get scared and kind of run away. Well, I think they should run at the clowns and capture them and bring them to justice. Let's face it. The clowns won't be able to run very fast in those shoes.
It's true.
And even if they've got a getaway car, they're not going to go very far once all the doors have fallen off.
Yeah.
And then when the seat goes up on the big spring, you can't drive it all the way up there. You could hear them coming. Not all the wheels are fully round. They don't go very fast.
Yeah.
This is not a hard crime to clamp down on, police. These people can't run very fast in the big shoes and can't drive very far in the silly car.
Yes, their capacity for stealth is quite low.
Quite low.
Because when they take a step, you hear...
Yes. They've talked about knives. They're worried about guns, but there's nothing to worry about, because when they pull that trigger, it's just a little flag that comes out and says, bang!
That comes out.
What are they going to charge these people with? Is it illegal to just dress as a clown? It's not an offensive way of, you know? And some ladies with too much makeup, you know, where do you draw the line?
That nose is quite off-putting.
I suppose, yes.
That's 5 years right there.
Wearing a loud nose and spinning bow tie in a built-up area, you think that could be an actual offence?
I suppose in some statutes, probably.
Yes.
That law could be there. You don't know.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. You know, people reckon that you know, the clowns have come up to them with a knife. Are you sure that when they stab you, the knife doesn't spring back into the handle? And that does not sound like clown MO to me. Don't they normally get you with a soda water fountain?
Or a bucket full of just paper shreddings.
Confetti. They throw a bucket of confetti.
Don't they throw that at you, confetti?
That's what they do. Yeah. And then they pull like 100 handkerchiefs out of their mouth, all tied together. is that?
I'm sorry, sir. That is too much concealer.
Yes.
Your skin is not that white.
Yes.
You're going to jail.
Yeah. These kind of people, they're giving clowns a bad name because some clowns just want to go about their business. It's bad enough that they get called names. Who's that clown? These legitimate clowns want to go about their business, and
they're just trying to make a few quid on the weekend.
Yep.
At a kid's birthday party.
Yep.
To make ends meet.
Yes.
And now what are they going to do?
Now that you know, they're walking home from a party after dark, all of a sudden surrounded by a SWAT team.
You know who's behind it?
Who?
Mimes.
I think that's where it started, because they're just creepy anyway.
It's mimes dressing up as clowns.
Yes.
To give clowns a bad name.
Yeah. Shot to the heart and you're to blame. You give clowns a bad name.
And now it's mimes going to be hired at birthday parties on the weekend.
Yeah. Take the work off them.
Take the work off the clowns.
Yeah.
It's all a mime conspiracy.
You're going to have...
The makeup is the same.
Yeah. You're going to have to be careful, though, because, you know, you could book what you think is a safe clown for, say, something like a children's party. And really, you've made a mistake and you've booked one of the scary clowns. And then you're in real trouble. I mean, how would you know? How can you tell the difference?
How would you know?
Yeah. I'm guessing if his balloon animals were all ribbed and lubricated, that might be a bit of a red flag. Don't you think? Thanks for getting in touch, Jim. And if you'd like to be on this show, all you got to do is send me an email. I'm graham@macmedia.co.uk. Put your phone number or your Skype details in there. I might call you. You might find yourself on the show. So here's what's going on in Britain right now, and it's not a good time for Boris Johnson. This is the bloke with the wild blonde hair that was the Mayor of London, and he became a Member of Parliament. Just before the Brexit referendum, he told everyone that he was in favour of Britain leaving the EU. Well, now a book has come out that claims that Boris wrote a newspaper article 2 days before he came out in favour of Brexit, and in the article, he went on about what a bad idea Britain leaving the EU would be, and warned of falls in the pound and economic catastrophe. Now, straight after the referendum, when David Cameron, our Prime Minister, became a lame duck because he was pro-stay in the EU, Boris put his hand up to be Prime Minister. At the 11th hour, he decided not to do that, and the eventual Prime Minister, Theresa May, made him the Foreign Secretary. However, he's in the Cabinet now because he was pro-Brexit, and it looks like 2 days before that, he was against it. Which means Boris was just playing politics and proves that the definition of politics is correct. It's a word in two parts. The first part, poly, which comes from the Latin for many. And the second part, ticks, which are blood-sucking parasites. Let's meet this week's guest. via Skype from his home on the other side of London, he is British actor, director and author Richard E. Grant. He's appeared in over 80 films and television programmes such as With Nail and I, The Scarlet Pimpernel, Jack and Sarah, LA Story, Dracula, Hound of the Baskervilles, Gosford Park, The Iron Lady and Downton Abbey. You've also got a line of fragrances out. What's your favourite smell?
Gardenia flowers.
What is it about gardenias you like so much?
I grew up with them in Swaziland, which is subtropical. And so the smell of them at night is about as sexy and erotic as any smell that I've ever smelled. And it's also the holy grail for me in that it's the one white flower that they've so far scientifically been unable to extract. So every one that's on the market is synthetic, which makes it even more, you know, it's not... It's just not available. You cannot put it into a bottle. So I love that.
But you are putting smells into a bottle. Does this make you what Withnail would maybe call a perfume ponce?
Absolutely. 1,000% perfume ponce, yeah. Guilty on counts.
It was an American girl, wasn't it, originally, that drew you to fragrances?
I had a big crush on a girl called Betsy Clapp, the double P, when I was 12 in 1969 in Swaziland. She taught me to French kiss, and I couldn't afford to buy her perfume on my pocket money savings. So I tried to make it out of gardenia and rose petals, boil them in sugar water, put them in jam jars, bury them underground for 2 weeks. And of course, they were just stink bombs. Anyway, it took 45 years later for me to finally, at the behest of handbag designer Anja Heinmar, she said, you should do something about this. So she prompted me and has been my great mentor. And so 3 years ago, I launched my first one.
And how does it work then? How do you get a fragrance into a bottle?
You go to Grasse in the south of France and you get as many samples as possible. And because I cook as well, I'm always thinking of ingredients that go together. So in the same way, it's the same way that I've operated with scent, that I got all my favorite ingredients together, which were lime, mandarin, marijuana, tobacco absolute, frankincense, nutmeg, and put them all together. And then I worked with a nose in Paris called Alianor Massenet, who then I said, how do I ground this combination and give it a kind of va-va-voom? And she said, oud. So oud is an ingredient that's from the Middle East. And so she added that. And I worked with her backwards and forwards and tested all my friends for about 6 months and finally arrived at this first formula, which was the Jack original, which was released 3 years ago and then won Best Independent Perfume Fragrance. So I was thrilled.
And that is the job title. The job title is nose.
Yeah, that's what they call it. I'm not a professional nose, but I work with a professional nose who turns what I make in my kitchen into a scientific formula so it can then be reproduced on a mass scale.
Did you have to get investors?
No, I said to my accountant, everybody advised me, whatever you do, don't go into this because it's you will lose your shirt. It's the equivalent of a 57-year-old man launching a pop record without any provenance of being in the music industry. So I asked the accountant what I would have spent on cigarettes and alcohol if I had lived as long as I have done. So he gave me a figure and I said, right, I'm going to gamble that amount of money on this fragrance business that I'm going to start up. And he thought I was insane. But anyway, after 7 months, we were in profit. So, you know, it's a happy ending. And the success of the first one has enabled me to produce a second one, Jack Covent Garden. And now the success of that has led to Jack Piccadilly 69.
And why is it called Jack Piccadilly 69?
Piccadilly Circus in 1969 was a sort of zeitgeist moment for me in that it was the year that they landed on the moon. So all things American were so exotic. It was the end of the 60s. I just came on a visit when I was 12 years old with my parents in May. And came out of Piccadilly Circus tube station, and the whole of Eros statue and fountain was literally covered in hippies, and the smell of patchouli oil was overwhelming. They then took me to see Hair, in which I saw Elaine Page's Minge, full frontal, unbeknownst. And I didn't know that she was Elaine Page then. I now know her very well, not in that sense. But so I saw Hair, went to Fortnum & Mason, had Earl Grey tea, the base of which is bergamot. They had leather seating. There's petrol fumes all the way down Piccadilly, which I love. So I put petrol, patchouli, bergamot, which is the base of Earl Grey tea, and leather all into this perfume. So it's an homage to that year. And it's also the year that the first film that I was ever in with Nell and I was set. So, and as I wore patchouli oil while I was making the film, you know, in homage to the character that I was playing, it's all of those things. That's the background story of why that's in. So basically, it's sex in a bottle. I saw see-through clothes in Soho for the first time. And so it was a hormonal rocket storm for me. So it's in homage to that. And of course, 69 is a sexual position, which you know about. If you read The Joy of Sex cover to cover, as I had when I was a teenager, you'll know that 69 features prominently.
So as you smell it today, does it take you right back to that time?
Instantaneously, because smell is the shortest synaptic leap in the brain between to your memory. If you haven't smelled something for X number of years and you smell it, you don't even need to think about where you were. You are instantly transported back to that moment you first smelt that smell.
Can we go back to the very beginning then? You're born in Swaziland, you grew up there. You actually grew up in a world without television.
Yeah, they got television in 1980 and I'd already left by then. I'd gone to university. So there was no TV. There was a BBC World Service. So I grew up on Round the Horn and Kenneth Williams' bizarre voice, or so it seems. I didn't know what he looked like. And Just a Minute and all those things.
And when you were 10 years old, there was a defining moment in your life.
Yeah, I woke up on the back seat of a car and wasn't obviously supposed to wake up. And I inadvertently witnessed my mother shagging my father's best friend on the front seat. So that's when I began. I tried God for sort of advice or solace, didn't get an answer. So I began keeping a diary because I couldn't tell anybody about it. And so I've been a lifelong diarist ever since. And then out of those diaries then made, wrote and directed an autobiographical film about starting with that scene called Wawa, which I made 12 years ago.
What was that experience like then as an actor to suddenly turn director, but the first one you direct, you're directing your own life?
Well, the advantage of that is that you are a middle-aged man post-psychoanalysis who has, you know, got all the ducks in a row or squared the circle, whatever it is, and come to terms with what happened when I was a child. So unlike being a child where you have no control over what adults are doing, going back in middle age and directing people to do all these scenes was great therapy. And of course, I was in total control of it. The painful part of it and the catharsis of it took during the writing of the screenplay and its many drafts. But the actual directing of it was probably the most creative and enjoyable experiences I've ever had. So it was all turned out good.
Did you ever talk to your mother about that?
Oh, yeah. 35 years after the event.
Oh, up until then, you never spoke about it?
No. She had no idea. I mean, how do you broach the subject of... actually, I woke up and saw you doing what I shouldn't have seen when I was 10 years old. It's not something in the way that I was brought up.
And did your dad ever talk about what happened, this incident?
Oh, I never told him that he went to his grave not knowing that I had seen this.
You wear two watches?
I do, yeah.
Why is that?
One is, my father, when he was dying, at the age of 52, when he could still just about speak, he gave me his watch. So I keep Swaziland time and his watch on my right hand, and where I am in England or wherever on my left hand. So as I'm failed all my maths at school, I can't count. So it's practical and sentimental.
And it's practical because you still got family back there.
Yeah, and I still got friends. So it means that I don't call them at the wrong time of the day. Yeah.
So you get into acting. Was that because there was no TV in Swaziland?
It's what I had always wanted to do. And I'm just very grateful that it's worked out, that I've been able to make a good living doing it.
And the first big break was with Nail and I.
I co-founded a theatre company when I was at university in Cape Town, 1,200 miles south of where I grew up. But the first film part that I ever got was exactly this summer, 30 years ago, playing an out-of-work actor, ironically. And I had been out of work for 9 months before I got cast in With Nail. So I had the best preparation for playing that part, full of bile, anger and frustration at being out of work, that character experiences.
Now, it was your big break, but as you say, it is coming up to 30 years. Does it bother you with all of the stuff you've done? And you've done a phenomenal amount of work. Does it bother you that people always bring up that film when they talk about your film career?
No, I understand it because that film has had such an ongoing... I don't know what it is, fascination or affection that people hold that story and that script in. And I so loved doing it, and I thought the script was so brilliantly written that if Daniel Day-Lewis had taken the part and I had not had the opportunity because he went on to do The Unbearable Lightness of Being instead, I know that I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you, and that, you know, it's a sort of chance of a lifetime that I know, having read the script, that if Daniel had played that part, I would have been as obsessed watching it as I know other people are that tweet me about it or, you know, ask me about it. So I understand that.
You don't drink or smoke, so a bit of a stretch for you as a first row.
Well, I tried cigarettes and I thought they were just, I couldn't get my head around why people would bother with that. And I discovered when I was 17 that I am allergic to alcohol, despite coming from a long line of alcoholics. So my father was a major alcoholic. So I had firsthand experience of what it was like to be around somebody who was drunk. So I think by, you know, not much osmosis, I could easily channel what it was like to be drunk.
And it was a handmade film, which was George Harrison's company. Did you get to meet him?
I did. I met George and met Ringo, and I subsequently met Paul McCartney, or Sir Paul McCartney, but he wasn't involved in the film company.
In your book, you write in some detail about how you lost your first child just before you started filming.
Right.
Did the writing it down, because you say, you know, you write in a journal, did the writing it down, did that help you through it?
I don't think anything helps you through it. It just, any kind of tragic loss like that, I don't know that you get, over the grief of that, you go round it, and there's not a day goes by that I don't think about it or am reminded of it in some way. But your life, you know, just the nature of how we survive and operate is that you go on, but you're forever marked. I mean, I remember my life before that happened and afterwards. So for me, it was a divider, if you like.
Was there ever a time when you thought, I'm not going to put that in the book?
I think that the pleasure I get out of reading published diaries is that you get the immediacy of somebody's life. And so it is very, I've just finished reading a very, very thick volume of Christopher Isherwood's diaries from 1960 to 1969. And seeing history through the prism of a personal perspective, I found much more informing about the writer and about the time that they were living through, rather than the sort of rosy, glossy version of, oh, you know, when I was back in 65 and I did this and I did that. Which characterizes so many memoirs, and they seem inauthentic to me because I think it's impossible to remember. I mean, I can't remember what I was doing last week, if you just ask me off the top of my head. But if I go to my diary and I look and I say, oh, that is what happened, that then triggers off the whole atmosphere and the memory of what that day was like, or who I met, or who I spoke to, or whatever happened. So I decided right up front that when the publishers said to me, do you want to self-censor your diaries? And I said, no, that is for an editor to do. I will give the whole splurge of it, hand that over, and then it's for them to edit down what they think should be in or shouldn't be in, and also has to go through the process of libel lawyers in case you talk about people and, you know, unintentionally insult them or misrepresent them. So I think that for the thing to be authentic, and that's what people responded to, and I think why it was a bestseller for so long, is because it's so clear that it's not something written in retrospect or rewritten or edited around. It is as it's happening. So if you're absolutely furious about something, you get that in that moment, even if a week later you get another diary entry saying, you know, I went off at the deep end and was completely unreasonable.
The other stuff that I was looking for is in there, the stories of what it's like to make a film. And I read the book before I watched With Nail and I. I watched it. Most people have had the experience in the reverse order. I read the book first.
Yeah.
So when, for instance, you get to the scene where you're drinking the lighter fluid, I laughed out loud because I'd read the book. And my wife's like, why are you laughing? And I think I had a better experience from doing it in that order, which I know is an unusual order. So thank you for putting that in there.
Oh, thank you. And apologies to your wife.
Yes, no, she's fine with it all. So the crew put vinegar in there for the take. They put water in there for when you swig it for the rehearsal and then switched it for vinegar.
They put some kind of, highly concentrated vinegar in there for the take. And so it was one take, and then I vomited all over Paul McGann's shoes, so... The director, you know, it has to be said, Bruce Robinson is one of my best friends, is a sadist.
What's been the best, of all the films you've worked on, what has been the best experience then?
Oh, writing and directing my own, my autobiographical film, Wawa, 12 years ago. That's by far and away the best experience I've ever had. And I know it'll never be, I can never have that experience again, because it was so entirely personal, and to just the unreality of having Julie Walters and Gabriel Byrne, all of these actors, Miranda Richardson, Emily Watson, Nicholas Holt, all playing me and my family in Swaziland, in the locations where all this stuff happened, was just beyond anything that I could have, you know, dared to imagine. And, you know, it happened. It took 5 years to get it done, but it happened. So I know that's a one-off in a life.
How close was it then to the real thing? Because there must have been certain artistic license.
Oh, yeah. Because you have to concertina, because the story happened over 3 years, and you have to get it down to 105 minutes of film. But when my mother saw it, she said, and I was very trepidatious about what her reaction would be, she said, that is exactly how it was. So I thought, oh, well. That's good, especially the scene opens with her being played by Miranda Richardson shagging somebody on the front seat of a Mercedes-Benz. Anyway,
she was okay with that?
Yeah, because I'd sent her the script in advance, and we had reconciled because I had told her what I was writing about, and she told me from her point of view what had happened to her in her marriage, and I told her what it was like to be the son of the husband that she abandoned, who then became a chronic alcoholic after she left, and basically suffered unrequited love for her, which she had no idea about.
You've also made a lot of films on both sides of the Atlantic. Are you following the US election race at the moment?
Microscopically, because I've just spent 3 months on Wolverine 3 in Louisiana, Mississippi, and New Mexico. And I had been in Washington earlier this year on Jackie, the biopic with Natalie Portman playing Jackie Kennedy, just on the day and the week after her husband was assassinated. And I relentlessly ask every single person in a cab, in a bus, in a tram, on the street, outside shopping malls, inside shopping malls, who they were going to vote for. And overwhelmingly, I heard Donald Trump, Donald Trump, Donald Trump. So when you're outside of New York or Los Angeles, where obviously all the people I know and most of the people that I met or polled unequivocally said Hillary Clinton, when it was outside of those cities, it was unequivocally going to be Donald Trump. So I fully expect him to be the president.
And how do you feel about that?
Well, I had the bizarre experience of interviewing him for a documentary series I did for Sky Atlantic called Hotel Secrets, and interviewed him about being a hotelier in the Trump Towers 3 years ago. So I'm hoping that I'm trying to get all the raw footage for that, because he was only supposed to speak to me for 10 minutes, 10 questions, and he ended up speaking for an hour. So if I can get that, I'm going to try and make a special in itself of interviewing the future president of the United States. And I find it so bizarre that somebody without any political experience whatsoever could be one of the two main runners for the presidency of the most powerful country on the planet is an astonishment. However, I don't think I need to tell you explain anymore where my feelings lie or who I would vote for were I able to, but yes, so I am very, very, very interested to see what is going to happen. Who do you think is going to be the president?
I don't know. I've not been in America since, I haven't been there since last, since June before last. So I haven't absorbed what the feeling is like. And that trip, I was in New York.
I think it's kind of like Brexit here. People said, oh, Brexit would never happen. It will never happen, including the people that wanted, you know, the politicians that pamphleteered for it the most. And they were then completely side upended, whatever you call it, when Brexit won, because none of them seemed to have even a 2-point plan of what to do if they did win.
Well, the most Googled phrase after Brexit was, what is Brexit? You know,
I think they know who Trump is. They know. And that's what they want. They want somebody who isn't a politician.
Yeah, and I get that. I get a frustration with the system. I spoke to John Cleese on this program, and he was just, his words were gobsmacked that he couldn't believe that in a nation with such a large population that the choice comes down to two of the most disliked people in America. And I think he's right. You know, I hope, you know, I hope Hillary can stop him, but I don't know if she's got it. I really don't know. And I kind of wish somebody else was there, that she's the only thing standing between, you know, him and ultimate power. You know, I think Bill Maher described him as Orange Hitler, and the way he comes across, I don't think that's too far short. But you've met him.
He is contentious, and he knows that he is contentious, and he knows that he says things that are provocative, and I think that that's part of how he's charmed people, because they think, well, this guy just says it like it is. It's not wrapped up in politspeak in any way. He reminded me more than anything of a kind of Barnum and Bailey ringmaster cracking his whip and knowing that he was putting on a show. So I don't really know how to. His hair is a masterpiece of spun gold. It's a work of art. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on then. You mentioned the hotel secrets. Jumping on the beds. What's that all about?
I've always done that, and I've always licked my plate. And we started shooting a series, the first series, in New York. And I did it on the first, no, two or three days. And when we started going to other hotels, because the rushes were obviously seen via the net immediately in London, when I went to a hotel, I think on the third day we were shooting, and they had already tested it on sort of ad hoc bunch of people in Soho in London, unbeknownst to me, the message came back, why aren't you jumping on the beds and why aren't you licking the plates? And the director not unreasonably said, well, we didn't think that that would be. They said, no, that is the signature of what this series is going to be. That is what viewers have responded to, good or bad. That is what they responded to. So they then said, right, you know, open sesame. You just carry on tally-hoeing and jump on the bed and lick as many places as you like, sniff everything in sight. So that's how that happened, by accident rather than by design.
Because you are quite a seasoned traveler. You don't like to take anything other than hand luggage. How does that work then?
Because it's very easy if you're a boy, because you know, have two pairs of shoes, you know, sufficient underwear, socks, two pairs of pants, and three shirts, and a couple of jackets. And that fits perfectly, you know, with a laptop and everything, iPad, into a pull-on suitcase.
But it was traveling light that nearly got you into trouble. You were accused of being an Egyptian terrorist.
Yeah, I was doing a mini-series about the kibbutz movement in the 1920s in Israel in 1987. And because I had an internal flight from Tel Aviv when I had 3 days off to go to Elat to go scuba diving, I didn't think to take my passport with me because it was an internal flight. And when I went through the airport at that point, they didn't ask for one. And when I tried to board the flight back, and I literally had a speedo, a pair of shorts, a T-shirt, flippers and goggles in Elat, I was taken off into a room, accused of being an Egyptian terrorist, and I was very, very suntanned. And strip searched with a, you know, torch shining up my Khyber Pass. So something that I would never like to repeat, and I haven't been back to Israel since on holiday. Let me put it that way.
So the tip is, if you're traveling there, always take a passport.
Always take a passport, yeah. It's very short-sighted of me not to have done so.
Well, passports brings us nicely to Passport to Pimlico, classic Ealing comedy. You've been doing a show about those as well.
Yeah, I made a three-hour documentary about the history of those Ealing comedies, which were made in the decade between 1947 and 57, the year I was born. And they really, I think, capture post-war British sensibility. You see lots of bombed-out London, which is very recognisable, and it had such a brilliant ensemble of actors, all of whom became household names, from Alec Guinness to Peter Sellers, Stanley Holloway, Joan Greenwood. Certainly, for an English audience, those names for a certain generation of people, you know, have resonance.
So, what else are you up to? What's next? Because you must be a workaholic.
I am a workaholic. I think because my father died when he was at 52, and I'm now 59 and three quarters, I feel that every year that I've lived beyond his lifetime is a bonus. So I was born impatient, so I like to get as much as I can crammed into a day as possible, up at dawn and go to bed literally when my feet are falling off. I've just been cast in a Disney version of The Nutcracker that Lasse Hallström is directing, with Keira Knightley playing the Sugar Plum Fairy and Helen Mirren and Morgan Freeman and some very young actors and Jack Whitehall, the comedian. So I'm doing that until the middle of January. So that'll keep me off the streets.
Yes, but if you are on the streets, you'll be smelling fabulous because you'll smell of Jack Piccadilly 69.
Yeah.
Launched last week at Liberty's, was it?
Yeah, exclusively at Liberty's for a month and online, and then it goes to other big luxury stores in a month's time.
Richard E. Grant. What does the E stand for, by the way?
Oh, there's another actor with the same name, and his name was Peter Grant when he became an actor, and he had to change it to Richard. So, and he very generously allowed me to put a letter in between, and when I spoke to the woman at Equity, I don't know, 30 years ago, or 35 years ago, she said, oh, well, if you're going to put a letter in between, what is it going to be? And she was on the phone, pre-internet days, and I went, R-A-G-R-B-G-R-C-D-R-D-G. She said, I haven't got all day! I said, right, Richard, E-E. So that's how it happened. Again, accident.
So it's got nothing to do with it actually being your real last name?
Yeah, because my full name, my legal name, is Richard Grant Esterhuizen. But when I went to drama school, they said your surname is unpronounceable, 11 letters long, and what is your second name? So I told them, and they said, right, you're going to be Richard Grant. So I did. And then when I emigrated to England in 1982 and then, you know, joined Equity, that's what they told me. So I was weird because I was with the late Paula Yates on the Big Breakfast bed on Channel 4's Big Breakfast program, and they had a live phone-in section, and a woman phoned in. It was 7 o'clock in the morning. Everybody was basically coked out of their brains, or seemed to be. And she said, oh, hello, I'm the widow of Richard Grant. He died 6 months ago. You can drop the E now. And I had to, you know, face full of teeth and smiles, try not to look gleeful, and said, well, I'm sort of stuck with it now. I think it'll be too confusing if I drop the E. But she was very generous about it. She said, oh, Richard was very pleased that his name actually ended up being known. So anyway, so that's a long answer to your very short question, as usual, has characterized our entire talk.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me. It's been an absolute pleasure. If America votes for Donald Trump, do you think you'll still be visiting the country just as much as you do now?
Well, are you going to stop going to Europe because of Brexit? You know, the world is the world. That's politicians are politicians. You know, somebody could just take him out, or he could be voted. Who knows what's going to happen? You know, the world goes on. You think that everything's going to come to a standstill, but unless it is Adolf Hitler with, you know, doodle bugs aimed towards, you know, your house building or whatever, you know, life goes on. So you have to just take it.
Richard E. Grant, thank you so much. I'm Graham Mack, and next week on London Calling, it's part two of my chat with Paul Gambaccini. Paul's an American, born in the Bronx, New York, grew up in Connecticut. came over to England in the early 70s and became an icon of broadcasting here with audiences in the millions on BBC Radio 1. But then, in late 2013, found himself out of work, unemployable and under virtual house arrest. Paul talked to me openly about what happened in part two of my chat with him, which you'll hear next week right here on London Calling. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk. Got a question or something to say, send me an email. If you put your phone number or your Skype details in that email, I might call you back on the show. I'm Graham at macmedia.co.uk. You spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next week. Ta-da.